Welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is May 3rd, 2017, and today we will continue with public hearing on SB 5535, and we will resume with tax cap and Mr. John. Before we get started, nothing from staff. Mr. John Hart, Senator.
I got one more, and I hate to keep grinding on this, but I was reflecting on our conversation from yesterday, and I would be appreciative if Ms. Waite could come back and answer a question about the audits and about cash.
Okay, Ms. Waite. And for the record, please state your name.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Waite, and I am the Administrative Services Division Administrator for the Department of Revenue.
Cool. I will admit to being pretty busy today, so if you have sent out copies of any of the audit material, I have not reviewed it. So I'm going from memory and reflecting on your testimony from yesterday. But one of the things that bothered me was that you said one of the significant or material findings in the audit was not doing cash reconciliations timely.
Correct. So, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator Johnson, one of the several years, actually, since 2011, we have had a material deficiency as far as doing our cash reconciliations timely. What that means is really we have approximately 11 cash reconciliations that we need to do. We make sure that 8 of them are completed and reviewed on a monthly basis. The review doesn't always happen as timely as we'd like, so there may be a month lag. Some of the smaller cash reconciliations for our smaller cash accounts, we have not been consistent in doing timely and having that review. I am happy to report that we are caught up at this time, and my reports as far as we haven't got all the audit reports back, and also my staff plan that's being reviewed currently by our communications team, but it does indicate that we are caught up. Everything has been reviewed.
Two other questions, one a follow on from this and one from something that you said in your testimony just a second ago. If you are struggling to do the cash reconciliations timely, how are you coping with the amount of marijuana cash that is coming through your facility right now?
Okay, so Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator Johnson, so yes, we are struggling. Those are really two separate reconciliation processes. So our cash transaction unit has employees that actually handle the cash, do the reconciliation, and do the reconciliation through the GenTax system. Our accountants do a reconciliation of the marijuana account, but again, it is not as complex because we don't have the ins and outs of that account at this time. Really, all that's happening within the marijuana fund is we're depositing the cash. It's sitting there. We do do what we call a reclass of expenditures. Yes.
Depositing it where, and where is it sitting, and who is the beneficiary of the accrued interest? Because I'm led to believe that there is a substantial amount of cash.
So, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator Johnson, so it is sitting in our cash account. We have a separate marijuana fund within our treasury accounts, and that's where it's sitting, and we are earning interest. Very small amount, but we are earning it.
Okay. So, I understand that it's easier because you don't have a revenue side and an expenditure side. You're just taking in the cash. There are anecdotal stories floating around this building of people showing up at revenue with shopping bags full of cash. Reassure the committee that given that you've had these findings in an audit that you're not reconciling cash timely. Reassure this committee that if somebody shows up with $80,000 worth of cash in a couple of sacks, how is that happening, and how are we assured of the accuracy and timeliness of the reporting?
Thank you for the question, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator Johnson. So again, that reconciliation of cash is really happening at the time that deposit's being made. The taxpayer brings in like a deposit slip per se, gives it to our cash transaction unit. They count the cash with one of our cash counting machines and do the reconciliation at that time. And then there is a dual control process where the cash is then counted a second time and reconciled to ensure that the amount of cash that we receive and the amount of cash that's deposited is accurate. We then do a reconciliation between what our receipts say and our marijuana cash account balance. Again, that reconciliation is not a difficult one, so it doesn't take that long, because we have we had a couple of expenditures go out in the balance transfers, basically, to OLCC to reimburse the liquor fund. We also do a reclass of expenditures of internal staff time that's spent on the marijuana program. So there's very little activity that occurs. So that reconciliation is very easy to complete.
Okay. Two more questions with your indulgence, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Have you, at Department of Revenue, or any of your sister agencies that you are aware of, have you heard any pronouncements from the new administration in Washington, D.C. about marijuana?
So, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator Johnson, I have not. And I'm not aware. I have not had any communication from any sister agency about what those communications may be.
Okay. Last question. You indicated that your response plan for the consistently bad audits is being reviewed with your communication people right now.
Correct.
And I presume that's for clarity or that's for whatever. But my interest is, has it been signed on? And maybe this is a question for Director Ray. Has it been signed off on at the director level? And are we just proofing it for clarity of presentation at this point? Is it ready to go? I guess I find it interesting that it's being shopped through the communications shop. And I just am curious if it's, other than syntax and clarity, is it ready to go?
So, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator Johnson, I have spoken to Director Ray about my plan and things that need to happen. The material deficiencies that we've seen in our audits, and also the staffing plan and how I plan to resolve those within the coming year and also next biennium, as far as aligning our budget structure, accounting structure, our cost allocation methodology, all of that. It is going through the communications group just for grammar check to make sure that I dotted my I's and crossed my T's. That's really what's happening.
Last question. Is your plan achievable? Because I came away from our conversation yesterday with an accelerated sense of urgency. This is a key agency charged with a lot of tasks. We just passed another bill across our floor today prescribing additional requirements for the agency. And I just don't know how having three biennia of bad audits. I just don't know how you could spill from one biennium to the next with bad audits and not throw up a flare that you have a major problem. I just don't know how our Department of Revenue can have ostensibly failed audits and it not be, you know, DEFCON 3 over there.
So, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator Johnson, I completely agree with you. I've been with the department just a little over a year and a half, and when I saw what the audit findings were, I was extremely concerned. We have already taken some mitigating action. I said, I believe it was first round. I may not have mentioned it yesterday. We have brought in a senior accountant 4 level retiree to help provide training, set up a year-end plan. So that's already underway. Again, this person has also assisted with training current staff in conducting the reconciliations and things that need to be looked for. And that's why we were able to catch up and also complete the review. So this has been one of my highest priorities to focus on. Last year, I have to admit, I was learning and trying to get up to speed about what were some of the deficiencies that we were facing in the finance area. And so now that I have a better understanding of how Department of Revenue works, the transactions that we need to be recording for year end, it is definitely my highest priority to get those areas fixed. One advantage that we have is we have a very good working relationship with SARS, which is the statewide accounting and reporting group at the Department of Administrative Services. They have been extremely helpful in going through our accounting and our transactions and assisting with any post-closing adjustments that we've had to make to ensure that the CAFR and our financial statements are recorded accurately. And they're also going through helping us with the lessons learned. So we are moving forward with implementing action plans now that we, again, I would expect to find another material deficiency in our reconciliations based on, not that we didn't get them done because we are, but as far as being timely, because we didn't get all of them done this fiscal year on a monthly basis. We just now got caught up. But the fact that we are mitigating some of those findings by saying, okay, we have completed all of them, so we are making steps to make sure that we improve.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gomberg.
No, Senator DeBoer.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple basic things.
Mm-hmm.
The marijuana cash intrigues me. And from what I understand, is there like $67 million flowed through your place? Is it all cash?
So, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator DeBoer, no, it is not all cash.
So some of it's drawn on FDIC banks.
So, apologize, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator DeBoer, some of it is. So we do receive some checks. We receive a lot of money orders.
Okay. And when you have two people counting the cash, I assume that the first person counts, a second different person counts it again, or is the same person count it twice?
No. So Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator DeBoer, we actually have a person counting it with the cash counter and a person observing it to make sure that, you know, there's no money that falls through the floor or the cracks or whatever. It's a dual control process. It's more of an observation. Then the cash is walked into what we call our reconciliation room, where there is another dual control process where a different person counts the cash and a different person observes the counting of that cash. So we actually have 4 people involved. Because of the volume and the amount of the cash, we believe that's the best controls. It actually mirrors the banking industry.
Good. And I understand you deposited at U.S. National. Is that, where's our bank account at?
So, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator DeBoer, that is our bank for the state at this time.
Thank you.
Thank you. So no further questions. Let's resume with Mr. John Hart, please.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, I'm Nia Ray, Director of the Department of Revenue.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee. I'm John Hart. I'm an economist in the research section at the Oregon Department of Revenue, and I'm glad to be able to pick up our discussion from yesterday. I'll do a very brief recap as we move back to slide number 2 of my presentation. The recap is, I think we talked about the estimate of the tax gap is a very rough estimate. The only person who can know the true tax that should be paid in our voluntary reporting system is the taxpayer themselves, and often the taxpayer themselves doesn't actually know the answer to that. So as we try to estimate it, it's a very rough estimate. We actually use net misreporting percentages as developed by the Internal Revenue Service through a extensive and expensive national research program that they've had. And those estimates, we believe the most important part of those estimates is the relative contribution of different income types to the tax gap. And we can see on the slide that we left off on yesterday that the misreporting percentage is related to the visibility of income. And also the visibility of income is usually related to the complexity of the income or of the net income that includes deductions. So when we actually make our estimates, we do it kind of line by line on the tax return. And this table shows the contributions of each type of income on the tax return to the gross tax gap. And you can see that we have $535 million of our gross tax gap is coming from one line, business income. It's actually a combination of several lines. But a lot of that is proprietor's income that's usually reported on Schedule C. And that's a line that has a net misreporting percentage, as estimated by the IRS, of 57.1%. And so where we would expect to see net income of $100, that net misreporting percentage is telling us that we're seeing net income reported of $43 for that type of income. And so even though only about 260,000 of our nearly 2 million filers have that type of income or report it, that's the major contributor. You can see that the highest net misreporting percent is on farm income. Farm income is often reported on cash basis, and you may have, for instance, some investments that are being expensed and that kind of thing that's contributing to that. But that's, even with the high net misreporting percentage, it's not as large a contributor to the tax gap. The bottom line, other income, has a net misreporting percentage of 63%. That includes other things. But one of those things that I think is included there that a lot of taxpayers don't even know is taxable is cancellation of debt. If you owe MasterCard $2,000 and MasterCard writes that off, that becomes $2,000 of taxable income to the person who had the debt written off. And so a lot of the information matching that we get from the IRS actually includes those cancellations of debt, and we end up billing a good amount of that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could you provide the number for MasterCard that wipes out $2,000 worth of debt?
Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, I do not have that number, fortunately.
Senator Fahey. Rep Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that include medical debt?
Co-Chair Manning, Representative Fahey, I believe it does include all medical debt. There are some exceptions. Principal mortgage debt is not always included, and some business debt. There's some obscure rules.
Mr. Chairman, does that include debt to other state agencies?
Co-Chair Manning, Representative Gomberg, I think it depends on the type of debt, but generally, yes, a debt that's canceled is taxable income. Okay. So moving forward to our summary of, we have a net tax gap and a gross tax gap for our personal income tax that we abbreviate as PIT, and for our corporation tax. The gross tax gap on the personal income tax is $1.8 billion. So the amount not reported and paid timely is $1.8 billion. We eventually receive, or we received as withholding that's never claimed on a return, about $500 million of that, leaving a net tax gap of $1.3 billion. And even that $500 million is an estimate, because for tax year 2014, we'll actually be collecting on that for decades to come. So we have to make an estimate of what we'll eventually collect. That, as a share of true liability, that's about 16%. For the corporation tax gap, we have very little information to go on, and what we have here is a lower bound on the corporation tax gap. Using the percent of liability that the IRS has estimated, we believe that our corporation tax gap for 2014 is a net of $95 million, which is a 15% share of the true liability. So as we talked about earlier, a lot of that is things that we can't find, and we can't find it because in some cases people are trying to hide it, or some cases people don't know it's taxable.
Okay, Mr. Hart, I want to ask you a question about that. I'll wait for collections to appear, and I'm hoping that they will have something similar in their presentation to address or at least probe why there's money out there that can't be found, and like for bieniums that have gone by.
Coach Manning, so there's a relationship between the tax gap and accounts receivable, and I think one of the things that we forget about accounts receivable is that I think about 40% of what we have in our accounts receivable right now is returns where the taxpayer didn't file the return. We filed the return on their behalf. And because we don't know about their situation, we often say they owe more tax than they actually do, because we don't necessarily know how much they had withheld from their tax, or we don't know how much mortgage interest they had to deduct. And so in a lot of cases, if those taxpayers do file, they actually will end up getting a refund. So we might carry, say, $100 on our accounts receivable from a non-filer and end up sending that person a $10 refund when they actually file later. So some of the money in our accounts receivable is also an estimate, and that can't be collected. It might actually represent, in some cases, an account payable, just because we don't have the information until we have that tax return.
I'm a little puzzled by that. You know, it's a little bit of inflated statistics stuff that's not really trued up, and maybe trued up at a later date or not. So, again, I'll wait for collections to come up and talk to them about it, because, you know, if from a layperson, you know, that say limited experience and stuff, that if I were to, you know, give some inflated numbers, not saying that, you know, this is what you're doing, but it's and come find out that after it's been trued up, there was something like maybe 20 or 10% over, that can create a big concern in some areas and stuff. So please continue.
Well, with that summary of the tax gap, we have references to reports that we've given the legislature in the past that provide more detail. The first report actually talks about how our philosophy in measuring or in specifying our enforcement revenue. The second one there, compliance with Oregon's personal and corporate tax programs, sources of noncompliance and discussion of the tax gap, gives a very detailed discussion of why we have noncompliance, kind of the motive and opportunity discussion, along with the details of how we make our estimates. And it has calculations for prior years and a little bit of discussion of accounts receivable there. A companion to that, at the time that was presented, there was a second part of a budget note that was being addressed with performance measures, benchmarks, strategic plan. That's there. And the audit selection process is actually a topic that you're about to hear about.
Okay. No questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And we will continue on. Next up to bat is revenue management, audit, and fraud detection. Kathy, is it Lolly?
Lolly, yes.
Okay. How about Ken Ross? Ken here?
Yes.
Okay, so I have you both here at the same time. Director, if you don't mind. And for the record, please state your name before you.
Thank you, Chair Manning, members of the committee. Katie Lawley with the Oregon Department of Revenue. I'm currently the Corporation and Estate Section Manager. I also recently spent about the last 3 years leading our income tax, personal income tax audit function. So to start out, I'd just like to talk a little bit about how we assign cases, audit cases, and how our overarching reasons that we do that. I'll just point you to the graphic on this page. On the chart on the left, the yellow part starts with the least complex types of audits that we perform. These are single issues generally on the personal income tax return, something like a tax credit or something that's generally very easy. These audits are done mostly by correspondence, so they can be done rather quickly and in a fairly high volume. Moving to the middle there on the complexity level, these cases are more complex because they involve multiple issues and they have multiple facets that need to be looked at by the auditor. These again are generally going to be on the personal income tax return. They could be employee business expense deductions on the Schedule A or a farm or a small business that's reported again on the income tax return. These audits take slightly longer and more resources to complete. The auditor spends more time reviewing documentation and communicating back and forth with the taxpayer to gather that information and to learn about the business or the deduction that they're taking. These again are a combination of both correspondence audits and in person if they are a little bit more on the complexity side. Then the final column there and the red side is the highest level cases that we complete. These are again anything from a higher Schedule C, higher gross income Schedule C, that is a business return or a pass-through entity, could be a domestic corporation or a multi-state corporation with a variety of fairly complex issues. Again, these audits are almost always going to be in person. Some will require travel to the taxpayer's place of business. That could be out of state and require several days at the taxpayer's location to review books and records and really understand the full compliance aspects. We select audits from each of these levels, and we have staff dedicated to each level of work. This strategy allows us to check compliance in a variety of aspects of tax law, and it's also an important part of the health of our audit program because we feel it has the greatest impact on taxpayer compliance. In general, the more complex an issue, there's a higher risk of noncompliance. As John already talked about a little bit ago, or maybe even yesterday, noncompliance comes in many forms. It can be intentional or it can be unknowing. When we're auditing, history has shown us that most noncompliance that we find is unintentional because people learn about taxes from a variety of sources. They learn what their friends are doing or their coworkers or their family, and that just doesn't always apply to how, you know, number one, their family may not be doing it the right way, and number two, it may not apply directly to the situation that they're in. So a lot of times we're using that as sort of an education tool. We're using the audit to educate the taxpayer on how to file into the future. The less complex audits also provide a lot of value because, again, we can perform a high volume of these with a fairly low level of resource. And then, again, this is one of our strategies is to sort of appear larger than we are. We liken it to having a police officer on the street corner. You know, you're not going to speed if you see the police car there. Again, we hope that people hear about us and know that we're auditing and do the right thing and learn about the tax law. Within the personal income program and the corporate programs, we have 77 auditors who focus on personal income taxes, 31 who focus on pass-through entities and domestic corporations, and 30 who focus on multi-state corporations. Just to give you a little bit of a scope of how many audits we perform, in the last calendar year, we completed almost 4,000 audits on personal income tax or individual returns, over 260 on pass-through entities and domestic corporations, and 175 on multi-state corporations. So next, I'd like to move on a little bit more about our philosophies on audit selection. One of our agency's main outcome areas is voluntary compliance. In other words, many of the actions that we take are to increase voluntary compliance. Now, auditing is definitely an enforcement activity, and we know that people aren't always voluntarily complying. But again, as I mentioned, we do strive and try to educate the taxpayers so that they can comply with the tax laws into the future. This also drives how we align our resources so that we're able to touch as many taxpayers as possible and really just making sure that our presence is known. One example of this, in a personal income tax audit, we often, one of the strategies that we use is to only audit one tax year at a time for the most part. And then if compliance issues are found, we obviously close out the audit and issue the bill. From there, we ask the taxpayer to go ahead and amend other open returns if we know that that issue is found on those returns. Not all taxpayers will do this, and we do have to sometimes just go and audit those returns. But if they do, that's helping them to learn how to be compliant into the future.
Ms. Lawley, I do have a question. On average, between individual and corporate audits, how often are recurring or corporate audits versus individual audits?
Thank you, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee. Are you referring to, like, cycle audits? Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. So for corporations, definitely it is much more likely to be doing a cycle audit because their issues are much more complex and they're filing oftentimes in multiple states. So they don't always track all of the differences in tax law. For individual audits, we really strive to not have to audit them year after year or every 3 years or however many. We really are hoping to educate them and move on to other taxpayers.
Okay, so most of the time the individual is not going to have as much more complexity as it would with corporations. So corporations that span across states, do those present an opportunity for the corporation to kind of shift books a little bit so that it looks like even though it was here in Oregon, it's being taxed someplace else, say, for example, Texas?
Right. Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, that's exactly right. So there are multi-state corporations essentially use an apportionment factor, which basically it's a percentage, and the percentage is based on, in Oregon at least, on their sales that occur within Oregon. And there's a variety of statutes and rules that define how they should determine that figure. Those rules are different in many states, and so it is a complex area, and it is one that we look at pretty much on every audit that we do, but it does provide them the opportunity to interpret things in the way that best benefits them.
So in order to help with revenue, would it be wise, since things have changed, would it be wise that the legislator look at those statutes and perhaps time to update those statutes?
Yes, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, there are some statutes that have been in existence since, I believe, the 1960s, and definitely business has changed since that time, and it would be wise to update those.
Okay. The next question is, have you revenue or could you or would you provide a list of those statutes that you feel need a relook based on current life itself, you know?
Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, yes, we can provide that.
Okay. Please send it to LFO and, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you actually took my last bullet point for me, but moving on. So the way that we look at cases, or the way that we select cases, we also like to balance those in a way that helps us to look at a variety of issues and taxpayers at various income levels. We do try to focus our efforts onto the riskiest returns with the highest risk of noncompliance, which we often equate to the amount of the potential billing. Income level isn't necessarily going to equate to a higher potential billing. And so for that reason, we don't necessarily focus on income level that's reported on the return, but rather we look at the whole return and how things play together. For instance, if you have a particular return that reports a certain level of income, we expect to see a certain level of deductions. And once the level of deductions maybe exceeds a certain amount, history tells us that there is a higher risk of noncompliance. And so those are the types of things that we look for when we're selecting.
Okay, I think that you may have answered my next question. I was going to ask, how do agencies prioritize their audits? Is it by the amount of potential dollars or to be collected, or how is that determined?
Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, that is one facet, the number or the amount of the potential billing. We also look at, I'll talk a little bit later about having multiple issues found on the return, because, you know, when you have one return that has five issues on it, it's not going to take quite as long as auditing five separate returns. So there are a variety of factors that we look at when prioritizing.
Okay, and you touched on those a bit during your presentation.
Yes.
Thank you.
So both in both of our personal income tax and corporate programs, we're utilizing the GenTax Discovery Module for case selection. This is a centralized process. So we have basically a small group of staff who perform that work. They ultimately program the system to identify the audits that will be performed. This centralized selection allows management to control how many of each type of audit that we are going to perform, and also to be able to make changes based on a changing environment or resource availability. It's also more efficient than having each auditor select their own cases because, you know, just having the system do that work for us is very helpful. Philosophically, our audit programs between personal income tax and corporate tax run in much the same way, but differences do exist with the amount of information that is available to us. For instance, with individual taxpayers, we have included in our GenTax Discovery Module DMV data that we can use to match up against income tax facets. We also receive federal tax return information, and this is going to be the main source of our audit selection for both personal and corporate taxes. For corporate taxes, again, there isn't a lot of third-party reporting. So as John mentioned previously, those things that aren't third-party reported are a little bit harder for us to find. The federal return and even the Oregon return can be somewhat complex. So we do have to do a little bit more of a manual review once the discovery system kind of selects some of those cases for us. Those are just some of the differences. A couple ways that we deal with that in the corporate tax program is by sharing information with other states who also audit the corporate income tax. And we also are members of the Multi-State Tax Commission, and they perform audits on behalf of many states. So that helps us with our resource levels.
So that's pretty interesting. So how does that work? So say, for example, you have a corporation that's based here in Oregon doing business in other states. This entity that you just spoke of, do they perform a different audit and report the findings back to everyone? So, for example, if there's a corporation that's not adhering fully and it's moving money around, does that agency or entity kind of work with you to say, okay, here's some money that you should have gotten and you didn't?
Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, so basically the way that it works with the Multi-State Tax Commission is we have a member who sits on their audit committee, and the audit committee essentially nominates taxpayers. So the states are essentially in control of which entities will be audited. Once those are selected, then the Multi-State Tax Commission assigns auditors, and then they go and do the audit. And then once they're done, these do take multiple years to complete because they can be auditing for upwards of over 20 states. So again, with those differences in law, it does take a long time. But yes, at the end of that, or as they complete for each state, they will report to us the changes, and we will bill the taxpayer and move on from there.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now that we've covered the background and philosophy, I'll just talk a bit about what we've learned over the past couple of years now that we're in GenTax. One of the benefits from Gentax for our audit program is that everything is now in one system. Previously, our audit system was separate from our accounting system, and so that meant that auditors had to sort of go back and forth between systems. They had to look for information in multiple areas and pull it all together, which, you know, it just created a level of complexity. It does make it much more efficient to select cases. It's also more efficient as we're completing audits. The data warehouse that I've mentioned a little bit does contain all the information that we know about taxpayers. That includes Oregon tax return data, federal tax return data, DMV, employment, and other sources as we gain them. This data is then used by the discovery system to select audits. This is better than our legacy system because the data warehouse will build up over time and be more useful as we gather more information about our taxpayers. The discovery system is actually used in much the same way as we used to select our audits, but there are some really nice improvements. The first benefit is that in our legacy system, once we ran a query and selected a case for a particular item, whether it be a business or a tax credit, that return was sort of pulled out of the population of audits. In Gentax, we're able to run all the queries at once, and like I said before, then we can identify that there are multiple issues on the return. This is really helpful because, number one, it saves auditor time when they're doing their pre-audit analysis. They still have to look at the return and understand how everything is playing together, but essentially we hope that we've identified the main audit issues that should be looked at. The other benefit is that we can now query return information based on the date received. Previously in our legacy system, the returns were separated by tax year. So that meant that taxpayers who are filing delinquently, whether it was on their own behalf or if we asked them to file and they did so, we had to select those audits or those returns for audit more of a manual process. And now we can look at them just based on the time period that was filed. Scoring and prioritizing cases isn't necessarily new, but we do have more information that feeds into the system. One of those is that the return is being selected for multiple issues. This tool is, you know, again, with the personal income tax program, they've been in the new system, Gentax, for about a year now, and this is definitely something that will benefit over time from gaining more and more information. So all of our previous audit information, there really was no way to sort of feed that into Gentax. So we're really starting fresh. And as we complete more and more audits in the new system, that scoring will become much more useful and sophisticated. One way that we determine productivity of our audit selection is by looking at the rate of cases with changes. So essentially for every 100 audits that we select, we hope that 85 of them at least, or 85%, have a change on them. We're currently running at about 80% across both programs, but I think that's part of our learning process in the discovery system. So we're learning about the queries that we're using. We're learning, getting good feedback into the system so that we can make those better. And I envision that improving back upwards towards that 85% mark. So if I can just direct your attention to the graphic on this page now, this data is compiled from our personal income tax audits. It shows the dollars billed per audit case by the type of audit, business cases, complex issues, and issues. The lighter blue bar is the dollars per case from our legacy system, and the darker blue is the dollars per case from our Gentax system. You can see that in all of these categories, the dollars per case are higher. And so that tells us that we are selecting the right audits and we are getting a benefit. So even though we have had more cases with a no change, we still are getting a higher percentage or a higher amount of dollars per case.
So previously, under the legacy system, potentially that could be attributed to the large volume, as I understand, of money that has not been collected. This new system here will help you identify those areas. So potentially those same people that have been audited in previous years probably have been ones that have neglected to fulfill their obligations in terms of taxes.
Senator Manning, members of the committee, yes. I mean, we do find that repeat offenders. I think that what this is showing us is that we are, that the new system is really helping us to identify all the issues on the return, and it's doing a better job of prioritizing those cases for us.
So, and probably this is would be a better question for collections. With the data that you have now to reflect back on the previous days or previous years, would this be a tool that you can say that perhaps, hey, we have you at this level and you have previously paid at this level. We need to take another look using this system versus, you know, the old legacy system. Mm-hmm. Would that be appropriate in your opinion?
Senator Manning, members of the committee, if I understand you correctly, I would say that essentially we are looking at the full population of tax returns that are filed every time we do a query. So it doesn't necessarily matter if you've been audited before or not. That could be a factor into the future, but right now it doesn't. Our system isn't really picking that up because we haven't been auditing in it long enough. So I would say everybody's essentially fair game for an audit. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Yeah, somewhat. I'll wait till collections come up.
Okay.
So, thank you.
Let's see. Okay, another benefit that also comes from having all of our information in one system is better audit inventory management. Auditors and managers are still getting used to this. They're still learning about the system and how best to manage their inventory. But there is a benefit of being able to see exactly what work is assigned to each auditor. It gives the auditor a good way to look at their cases and see how many days it's been open or how many days since they've looked at it. And it gives managers that ability as well. So during the planning phase or configuration phase for GenTax, each program looked at possibilities for going as paperless as possible. One way that we've used this in our audit program is that our GenTax system now holds all the relevant information from an audit. So any documentation that we get from a taxpayer, any notes or phone calls that we need to document are all contained within GenTax. This means that we don't need to print out an audit file. We don't need to combine different things together. And then for audits that are reviewed, they can be reviewed essentially from anywhere. We don't have a paper file moving around, which slows down the process. This initial work that we did in the system also created more consistency in how our audits are performed. We had a group that worked on work paper standards and just ensuring that we're all the auditors are essentially using the same type of work papers, which again makes review easier, and it also is a more consistent experience for our taxpayers. And then finally, as we were configuring the system for auditing, we had quite a bit of control over which data fields would be available. Now, we haven't perfected that yet, I would say, but we were able to think about the types of reporting that we would want out of the system and make sure that those data fields were captured, both for reporting outward and also for internal understanding how our programs are performing. And again, as I've said before, as more audits are completed, there are analytic features that GenTax provides. So again, the system itself will feed back in, and depending on what the result of one audit is, based on the queries that selected that case, if it's good or bad, it's going to raise the score of those returns or those queries. So I'll just wrap up by saying we're very excited about the future. We continue to improve upon the great new tool that you've given us. And this completes my update on audit selection.
Okay. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do the feds notify you when they're auditing an Oregon resident? And do they share the results if they do?
Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator DeBoer, they don't notify us at the time they're auditing, but we do get the results once the results are complete.
Does that then generate a bill correcting the federal, which we use as a basis,
right,
automatically from your department?
Yes, Co-Chair Manning, Senator DeBoer, are members of the committee. Yes, we generate a billing, a deficiency notice that goes out to the taxpayer. If they don't, the taxpayer could essentially amend their own return, which we hope they do, but if they don't, then we will bill them.
Under your type of audit there, your little thing, I noticed that it's 17 months for the upper category and I think 10 months for the lower category. It's sometimes hard to compare if their time frames aren't the same.
Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Senator DeBoer, yes, and we could have updated that a little bit. This was from our budget book that we presented or that we provided. I did get assurance from our program staff that those figures have not changed significantly.
But it would have helped your numbers. I mean, you almost hurt yourself by using a shorter time for the light blue and a longer time, mm-hmm. vice versa. So.
Any other questions from the committee? No, thank you. Well, sir, I don't know, Ken, if you had anything to add to this, or you just
actually, Co-Chair Manning, I'm here to present on fraud, refund fraud.
All right. Well, let's rock and roll.
Thank you. Are you going to run it, please? Yeah. Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, my name is Ken Ross. I'm one of the personal income tax program managers at the Department of Revenue, and I'm going to talk on refund fraud. And I've got a few slides, give some a little bit of history, how we got here. I've got one slide on numbers and then where we're at today. Refund fraud, I first want to get into what we're talking about here. We used to call fraud altered W-2s, enhanced deductions, people making up a person because we didn't have the means to validate anything. We still have some of that today. People still make stuff up, believe it or not. But that's not the fraud we're talking about here. And what we're talking about is identity theft and stolen identities, stolen W-2 information, and it's become big business. It's become very popular and across the nation and with the federal government because the criminals see it as easy money, basically. They 41 states have an income tax with a withholding program with a potential for an overpayment and a refund, as does the federal government. The reality is anybody with a computer, an internet connection, and the right information can file a return for asking for a refund from anywhere in the world, and they do. The truth is that most of the identity theft, the refund fraud that we see in the state is not necessarily generated from within the state. It comes from other states. It comes from out of country. This year, Nigeria has been kind of the ringleader in the refund fraud world.
God, I thought they just liked me.
Just a couple notable issues on refund fraud. If we pay out a refund that's fraudulent, basically we're out the money because, one, we don't know who actually asked for it because the name on the return is not the person that got the money, and we a lot of times don't know where it came from. And it's potential for the state to be out the money twice because if the real taxpayer happens to live here and files their own return and asking for a refund, we will issue that. They're going to get their money that they're due.
So before you go on, so this seems like this is a major, major concern here. I'm assuming that under the new Gentex system, you have some way to determine, or will that be later on in the presentation?
Co-Chair, it is later on.
Okay.
Yes.
I'll sit
Thank
back.
You. And because of because we don't know who it is, collection we can't pursue collection because we don't know who they are. A little bit about how we got here, just real quick. We've created our own little dilemma here. We have pushed for we being the tax administrators, states, the IRS, since the early to mid 90s. We pushed e-file because it's fast and it's efficient. Obviously, if we get an e-filed return in, we don't have to go to the post office and pick the mail up. We don't have to open envelopes. Once it hits our system, it processes without manual intervention for potential. And it's It's also more efficient for the taxpayer because it's software generated, and so it answers all their questions, and it's more right, I guess is one way. The error rate on a software generated return is much lower than that of a paper return. So if you throw in, you have that goal that we had to file electronically, get your refund really fast, and you throw in refund fraud, now we have a dilemma. We have competing goals, getting the refund out the door promptly and doing our due diligence in verifying the accuracy. It's because the trade-off there are trade-offs, and as you'll see, I've noted here, and Joanne talked on Monday a little bit about our processing times. To do fraud detection, it takes a little more time. We have to slow down the process. It took, and you'll see by these numbers, 3 years ago, it took 5 days for a return to get through our system. An e-filed return that took no manual review took 5 days. We slowed that down. 2 years ago, we intentionally slowed it down by 3 days to put in some extra manual review. Last year, we took 22 days. Now, some of that it was intentional. Some of it was not intentional. Brand new system with a very, very complicated system, Gentax, with a high learning curve. We had issues with our data entry. Last year, we weren't very good. I think you heard that from Joanne on Monday, that when it came to processing returns last year, it wasn't very pretty. And we heard about it. I'm sure you heard about it. We heard about it from you. We have a where's my refund application that people can call in or get online, and it'll put in your information and tell you where your refund is at in the process. And last year we had over 1 million hits on that application.
Representative Gomberg, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I apologize for jumping in and out today. I'm testifying on three bills in two different committee rooms. Is it Mr. Ross?
Yes.
Actually, I was on your webpage earlier today and looking at that very feature, so I appreciate that. My question is this. How is the volume of fraud and the detection of fraud affected by the personnel vacancy rates that we have within the department right now?
Co-Chair Manning, Representative Gomberg, there's not a direct correlation. We don't have a vacancy in that area. It's likely as we get better in this system, we learn what it can do, that we'll be back here asking for more people to do that. But as of right now, we don't have any vacancies in that area.
Thank you.
On Monday, when Joanne was testifying, there was a question about how our processing rates compared to other states. And so I thought I'd just address that today if I could. We don't have, the states don't put out their information out there, how fast they do, but I went to our neighboring states' websites and looked at what they say, what to expect. And even though each state's a little bit different in how they treat their income tax and the priority, a lot of states have a sales tax, which is their priority. We're all in the same boat when it comes to refund fraud. So the IRS says they'll issue most refunds within 21 days. It doesn't say how well they met that, but that's what they put out there. California says if you e-file, expect 2 weeks. If you send paper, expect 4 weeks. Utah's a little bit unique. They say 60 days if you e-file and 90 days if you send paper. And Utah also has a law that says if your information, your W-2 information, isn't in our system from your employer, we won't issue that refund until March 1st. So they have that in statute. Idaho says 7 to 8 weeks if you e-file, 10 to 14 weeks if paper, and Idaho also says if it's the first time you filed with us, add another 3 weeks to whatever your method of filing is. So we're all pretty similar. We say the same thing. I think we're pretty comparable as when it comes to processing. Uh, a slide on where the data comes from. And data breaches has been huge because we are talking about stolen identities, stolen information. I listed a few here just to get an idea. These are breaches that have happened within the last couple years. The IRS got hit a couple years ago with their Get Transcript application. 700,000 people have potentially had their information compromised. Another federal level Office of Personnel Management was compromised. 4 million people impacted. Oregon Fish and Wildlife wasn't their system, but the system, they have a vendor that does multiple states, I believe it is, that houses their fishing and hunting license applications, and that got hit a couple years ago. 1 million people potentially affected. A couple big companies, Yahoo, Anthem, in the last couple years, both of those have been hit. Yahoo was hit twice, and over 1 billion people impacted. This year, we've seen and heard about a different target. They're targeting tax professionals, becoming way more sophisticated. They have the ability to get into a system, a tax professional system, intercept a return after they've hit send, e-file it, go in, change the bank account information, and then let it go on its merry way. So everything is on the return is right, except they've changed where the refund is going. Phishing, with a P, not so sophisticated, but very popular this year and very successful. This basically is where somebody, a fraudster, creates an email that looks authentic, that's coming from the top person in the company, the CEO, whatever it might be, and they're sending it to personnel in the company that have access to employee records and say, hey, I'm going to a conference next week. I need all the employees' W-2 information to take with me. And they are getting responses. Really? And so all this to say that in just the first 3 months of this year, we learned of over 500 successful phishing expeditions, for lack of a better word, in the nation. That's not just in Oregon, but it has been very successful. And here in Oregon, I threw on there one. It's not limited to businesses. My alma mater over in Redmond, their school district got phished this year. 1,000 employees had their information sent out by email. All this to say is that it's made our fraud detection life very difficult. The returns look much more real than they did in the past. It's made it very difficult to determine good versus bad. One slide on numbers. We've started keeping statistics on our frauds in 2010 and last year. 2016 season, we stopped almost 7,800 returns to a tune of $5.1 million in stopped refunds. We paid out 33 that we know of to the tune of about 56,000. And that paid out column should have an asterisk. Like I said, that's what we know about. In the fraud world, we don't know what we don't know. If we don't get information that we paid out a refund and all these, we got information after the fact from whatever source, another state, the IRS sent us information, said, hey, you should be looking for these characteristics, and we'll run it through our system. We say, oh, we had that, one of those, and we've already paid it out. We find out about it after the fact. And sometimes we find out in time to stop it. Sometimes we find out in time to pull the money back from the bank. But in most cases, it's gone. And like I said, if we paid out a refund and we don't get information about it, we don't know that we've paid out a refund. Just one little note on the difference, the jump in number of returns that we found in last year versus the year before. It nearly doubled, and we're first year in our new system, and it's hard to draw conclusions yet, but we can speculate that this new system allows us to send letters and ask people to validate their identity. And we think because of that automation, it allowed us to get deeper into the fraud pool. as it were. We had more automation, less manual, so we could get to more returns. And we send out these letters. We send out. We ask for either to validate your identity, send in as hard copies, or take an identity quiz. We sent out about 21,000 letters in one of those forms, and the letters that we didn't get a response to. When we sent them out a couple different times during the season, and then we followed up with a letter after the extension period was over and said, hey, still got your refund. We haven't heard from you. We're not going to issue it unless we do. We heard from more people, but not all of them. About just almost a third of the people did not respond. And so we made an assumption, and we may still hear from these people, and we can undo our assumption. But we assumed that if we didn't hear from them, it was a fraudulent refund. Because most people who are due a refund are pretty diligent about following up and getting it. Last slide. Talk a little bit about where we're at right now, 2017. So we were in here, I believe it was in front of this committee. We asked for a policy option package back in 2013, and it was a two-parter. We asked for a one-time purchase money for about $360,000 to go to employment, to ask them to revise their form that they get quarterly from the employers that reports wages and withholding. We asked them to actually include withholding on that form and to reconfigure their system so they could accept it. They did that. Last year was the first year we got that information quarterly, and we are now using that to validate returns. The second piece of that option, that package that we received, was to buy the analytics, to buy this new system module to go with Gentax. And that was about $750,000 for that biennium, this biennium. And what it bought was analytics. It bought access to public data. So the company that we went through last year, Thomson Reuters, they have millions of records that we use. It's designed to get at identity, validate identity. It also bought the identity confirmation, the ability to send letters, and we built an online identity quiz so people can get on and validate their identity online. It also puts us in a club, if you will, for a data exchange with other Gentax states. So we're running analytics against the public data. We're running analytics against what's in our system. And then we're also seeing what's happening in getting to use data from other states in the system. I know I would assume there's a question about ROI, return on investment. For what we received, like I said, last year was our first year, so it's a little early to delve into the ROI, but like I said earlier on the numbers page, that we think we've automated, we can get to more returns. We don't see fraud as something that's going to go away as long as the opportunity is out there. We have the income tax system the way we do. We're going to see fraud. And so this system is going to help us keep up with the sophistication. We added more staff this last year. Gentax brought us automation in our filing and enforcement, which you heard about on Monday from Joanne. We were able to repurpose positions from the filing enforcement as we automated a lot of that work. We moved them to the fraud world so they could help us with the returns that we need to look at there. So we had five permanent staff in fraud this last year. We have two seasonal people in that they help us seasonally, and they have other duties. They help us get our systems ready for the filing season each year. The analytics, a little bit about the analytics. It scores every return that comes through our system, and there were 2 million of them last year. We score every return, whether it's refund or tax to pay, and we put it on a scale of 1 to 100, and 1 being totally the real person, send them their refund. 100 being totally fraud, don't send that refund. And then somewhere in the middle is where we generate those letters. So we just don't have enough information, so we ask them to take an identity quiz or to send us documentation.
Mr. Ross, can I ask you a question real quick? You said that there are people that kind of augment your current staff level at that time. Are these some of the people that I've heard referred to as being double spotted, or maybe that's another question I'll have offline or something like that. Are they FTEs with DOR and just spotted in, just moved around just to help out temporarily?
Co-Chair Manning, they are our full-time employees. They just have dual duties. We ask, they have system-related duties during the time of the year where we're readying our system for the next filing system. And when they're not doing that, we ask them to help in fraud because they have more capacity to do that. The system allows us to have better matching capabilities, and we are trying to take advantage of that. This year we held refunds till mid-February. We didn't issue any refunds till February 15th this year, and that allowed us to get the employer information that was due on January 31st, allowed us to get it loaded into the system so that we could match what's reported on the return versus what's reported by the employer. And we anticipate that we will continue to do that. Just one little other matching thing that's not necessarily related to fraud, but just to give you an idea, we also have built in our area, we have a tax credit module that we've built, and we have partnered with all the agencies that certify tax credits. So, for example, energy. So if an individual earns or receives a credit, an energy credit of whatever dollar amount, that information is sent to us so we can match that on the return when the return comes in, and we have the ability to track that. So if they claim more than what was issued, we have the ability to say no. If their tax liability is such that it won't allow them to claim the entire credit and it sums available for subsequent years, we're able to track that carry forward also. So it's just to give you another idea of some of the tracking capabilities, matching that we can do with the system. And the last thing I want to mention is just our partnerships. Fraud has been a big concern nationwide, and with the IRS, created a security summit 2 years ago, which all 40 states that have income tax programs joined, Oregon being one of those. It's designed to specifically to get at refund fraud, to share information. We signed a memorandum of understanding to share information. It's also joined by 20-some tax industry software companies and bank, the financial institutions have also joined. So it's a consortium to share information to get at fraud and to have an early warning system, so to speak.
Senator?
With that communication linkage, are you able to identify frequent flyers? Are these guys so sophisticated that you could be a pattern and practice of tax fraud would be shielded from your view, or can you see in various jurisdictions the same operatives engaging in the same bad behavior?
Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, yes, that's exactly what we can get at, and that's the type of information that's shared, that if one state is seeing something that is showing up multiple times, they're going to share it with the other states so that we can look for the same thing. The whole point is that information sharing so that we, if we're seeing something, it's likely that somebody else is seeing it.
Follow.
Are you able or do you share that information with law enforcement to try to get some of these very sophisticated fraud perpetrators?
Co-Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, yes, to a limited, it's limited in Oregon, and it might not just be Oregon, but because most of it occurs, most of it's generated from outside the state, we have limited ability within our boundaries. We have worked with the IRS. We are finishing up a big case that was generated, the ring was actually out of country, and we've worked with the IRS to help provide information for prosecution.
Thank you.
Okay. I think with that, I'll close and I'll answer other questions if there are any.
Okay, Mr. Ross, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. No questions from the committee. Committee members that were not present, just want to kind of share a little bit with you during Ms. Lolly's presentation. Asked a couple of questions, and apparently we've got some statutes on the books in terms of how we are taxing people that are fairly outdated. So I've asked her if she would supply us with a list of those and possibly recommend that we refer those over to the proper committee to relook those, to update those, because everything has changed now. And if we still have old books and tax methods and statutes and stuff, in the current condition that we are in terms of not having the revenue, maybe it's an opportunity that just came to our door. So once we get those, then we'll provide those same statutes with everyone else and then seek some kind of a consensus on where we need to move those. The next up we had was the collections department, but doggone it, we ran out of time, and I don't want to get started on that, so I assume that we will come back tomorrow, and we will start in with collections. No further business here. At this time, we will go ahead and adjourn today's meeting and reconvene tomorrow's meeting at 3 o'clock, in case there's anything else from the committee. All right, we are adjourned.
Thank you, sir.
All right, we are adjourned.